All right, make sure you're alive out here. As Daniela said, my name is Ruth. My pronouns are she, her, and hers, or your majesty if you like, if you prefer using neutral ones. Your majesty is always a neutral one, as is foolish mortal. We need to start out with a couple of disclaimers. This is me talking. Not my employer, not my family members, not some friend of mine, not any nebulous community that I may or may not belong to, just me. As Daniela had mentioned, I have worked for 30 years in IT. Right now I write Perl. I see the derision on a couple of faces anyway. I write Perl for a living, and it pays better than anything I've ever done, and I'm liking that. But that's not my real job. I believe very strongly that my real job is to care about people, all of you. That's what I do. The rest pays the bills, but this is what I do for a living, is take care of people. And some of you may disagree with me, perhaps stridently, and that's okay. Why do I do this? Because every time I get up and talk about this kind of stuff, I get crap on my Twitter feed. I get abuse on my Twitter feed fairly often as a result of these talks. Why do I do this? Michael Clark Duncan said it. I'm tired, boss. I'm tired of all the pain and hurt that I see in the world. It's like pieces of glass in my head. I'm tired of watching people hurt each other. So I get up and do this. Let's start with an exercise. Now, this is going to be a little tricky because there's a lot of empty space out there. And plus, I get the sense that most Apache people know most other Apache people. I don't know how that is. People say that about the transgender community too, but we can't even spot each other half the time. So I have a job for you, and Jim, this is going to be hard for you because you know everybody. Find someone near you that you do not know, and you're going to exchange two things with them. One is a greeting. You can say hi, you can say hello, you can say howdy if you're from Texas like me. You can offer to shake hands if that's a thing in your culture. You can decline one if that's a thing in your culture. And you're going to exchange one byte of information. And that byte is an integer, a non-negative integer. The number of Apache cons you have been to before this one. There's two rules to the game. One, do not ask any questions of the other person. And two, do not offer any other information. Just a greeting and one bite of information. Can we do that? Everybody clear on the rules? You have 60 seconds to do it. Ready, steady, go. You might exchange greetings with another extra person if there's someone around looking for somebody. Do what? That doesn't count. You know them. It is. 30 seconds. Okay, you're doing pretty well at that. Got a few seconds left to get back to your seats. No rush. All right, Jim yelled it. It's hard. How many of you found this really, really challenging to follow the rules? You want to give them something else, don't you? Hi, I'm Jim. Right? You want to do that. You want to stick your hand out and say, hi, I'm Ruth. You want to break the rules. There's a reason for that. And I think the reason is because we as human beings are powerfully driven to connect. It's a thing that we try to do. Even in that small moment when you're meeting this stranger sitting next to you. But consider for a moment the stranger sitting next to you. You don't know anything about them that is important. You don't know their name unless you've cheated and looked at their badge. You know the color of their skin, you know that they're here, and you know one mostly useless integer. You don't know where they're from. You don't know their educational background, their family background, their career trajectory. You don't know who they worship or if they worship. You don't know anything about their faith or spirituality or sexuality or any of the things that define us as human beings. But wouldn't you agree that that person you met is worthy of dignity and respect in their personal and professional lives? Most of us would buy that. Well, what about the person on the far side of the room that you didn't meet because you're over here? Or vice versa, of course. They're in the room with us, but you didn't meet them. Are they worthy of dignity and respect? Yeah, we could buy that. Well, what about our colleagues that skipped this session because they're doing something else? What about them? Yeah, okay. And the colleagues you left at home who are not at ApacheCon, how about them? Where do we draw the line? You say that, and I see a lot of thought balloons of people saying that, but we do. And I'll talk about that in a minute. We're here to talk about empathy, and we're talking not about this. Catherine Hayes, the late Catherine Hayes, who, without a word, created this enduring character. We're not about that kind of empathy either. Sorry. So here's the base case for empathy. You see someone in distress, someone who has a problem or an upset, and you, having been through something similar, feel some similar emotions. We call that empathy. And that can express itself in a number of ways. One is through feeling sorrow or concern and trying to communicate that to them. We call that sympathy. And then feeling a drive to act to relieve their suffering. We call that compassion. So that's the definitions we're working off of here. When I talk about empathy, these are the things I'm talking about, that connection of emotion with somebody else's situation. There's three kinds of empathy. We've scienced this. We've figured this out. The first kind is physical. If you see a photograph of somebody hitting themselves on the hand with a hammer, your hand hurts. And the reason for that is the neurons in your brain fire the same way as when you hit your own hand with a hammer or whatever the trauma is. Now, it's weaker because the pain receptors in your hand didn't fire. But your mind remembers, and you remember that trauma for yourself. And you feel that pain in sympathy with the other person. Emotional empathy. Emotional empathy is when you see someone going through something that you've been through before, and so you feel as you did when you went through it. Now, notice that I didn't say the way that other person feels, because it might not be the same, right? Okay, so by the time you reach my age, you've lost people in your life who were important to you, parents, family members, brothers and sisters, those kinds of people, and the beloved uncle, you know, I think many of us have one of those. Well, if I see another person who's lost a close family member, I remember those losses myself. But if that person just lost their abuser, they probably don't feel the same way I did about my beloved uncle, don't you think? That is the trap of emotional empathy. That is the hazard of overuse of emotional empathy, is because what somebody else feels about an event is not necessarily how I feel about it. I feel back the way I did, but that might not be what they're feeling. It's a trap. Intellectual empathy. This is the kind where you see somebody else's circumstances and through intuition or whatever, you figure out how to feel about that or how they may feel about that. All right, clearly, I have never lived in a country in the middle of a famine. I mean, look at me. Right? But when they show me pictures of starving children in the third world countries on television, I can look at that and go, that's bad. right? That's not good. And NGOs actually utilize this kind of intellectual empathy in order to raise money. That's what they do. That's their job. Empathy has no script. All right, those of you that are looking for a magic bullet on how to do empathy, you're out of luck. Can't help you. There's not one. Empathy, and this is Brené Brown. She's at University of Houston. She studies vulnerability and empathy and compassion for a living, written 4 New York Times bestsellers. She did a TED Talk a few years ago. It's had like 40 million views or something. And she talks about the power of vulnerability, the power of being open to being hurt anyway. Even though you know the hurt is coming, you're open to it anyway. That kind of vulnerability. And she describes it as crucial to creativity. Without that vulnerability, the willingness to fail, we are not creative people. And she says that empathy is not communicating to somebody that you feel the same way they did, because sometimes you don't, like I talked about with emotional empathy. It is merely holding space and being open to let that other person feel whatever it is they're feeling, for good or ill, and communicating the incredibly healing message, you are not alone. If you want a synonym for empathy, it is acceptance. Nothing more or less. You have had something terrible happen to you, and it causes you to feel in this way, and that's okay. And I get it. That's all that empathy really is. This is not a master's level course. I'm sorry. We get told in the West a lot to leave it at home. Leave your outside concerns at home when you go to the office. Now, if you work at a factory, there's a certain wisdom to that because of safety, right? You don't want to get injured by that car you're trying to put together or whatever it is. But those of us in IT in particular, that doesn't make sense, and there's a number of reasons it doesn't. Number one, it's unrealistic. If your house was just damaged by a windstorm and your spouse has stayed home to talk to the insurance adjuster, or your child has been studying for a test and you know they're taking it at this hour, you're going to be thinking about that. My coworkers told me they wish this was on a stream so they could watch. They're thinking about me in 4 time zones right now because they can, because leave it at home is unrealistic. It is unhealthy because it causes stress. You get worked up about the fact that you've wasted time being worked up about that externality, and then that just kind of piles on, and it's also unproductive. So leave it at home. Managers in the room. How many managers do we have in the room? Bosses, managers, supervisors, whatever you call it. If you're propounding this philosophy of leave it at home, realize that you are doing harm to your workers. Not just their productivity, but also their health. Just so you know. Talk about the place I work. Now, this has never been seen outside of company circles until right now. We're unveiling this new logo today at ApacheCon. I wish we had a full room. The company I work for has been around for 25 years. Most of that, it was 2 guys who met in college. They've been good friends. They write business applications, business process automation, web applications. We put them out in the cloud. And our job is to make other people's jobs easier. It's just that simple. Our principles, our guiding principles at the company are that our people come first. It's a common fallacy in business to say the customer always comes first. Our business deliberately does not say that. We say our people come first. Because if we take care of our people, then they will take care of the customers. Splendidly. That's how we do it. And empathy is at the core of what we do. When we get a new project, my boss goes and he will spend a week with the other person's operation, and he'll go out in the field and work the machines and whatever they'll let him do so that he understands the pain point of that business process that we're going to automate. So he understands where the line workers are suffering and why, and how, and that then leads him to how we can fix that. And what processes can we automate that will save them time, money, effort, and suffering. Empathy is at the core of what we do at Clearbuilt. And I've said this before, my previous job had some great benefits. Free cell phone, free lunch every day. They took us out for fun and games every quarter. Covered parking, charging stations for electric cars, lots of goodies. But the benefit I have at Clearbuilt costs them nothing, and my previous employer can't afford it. And that is respect in my person and in my profession and in my expertise. I am respected at Clearbuilt, and that's why I'm there. All right, if you don't have an employer like that, move. Bosses of all types, let's talk about the business case for empathy and openness. At my previous job, one of the nice things was my teammates, some of them were and are my best friends. And these were people I worked with every day on my team. We were Scrum Shop, and my Scrum team, my product owner, was and is one of my best friends. All right, so there's a lot of benefits to this kind of openness. Better team cohesion, better team dynamic. Even though I'm no longer on the team, I still adore those people. I still spend time with those people when I can. Better job satisfaction. Look, if you go into the office every day and you're scared of your coworkers, that's not a recipe for job satisfaction. And I have been in jobs where I was frightened of my coworkers, which sounds absurd to some of you. I can see the little thought balloons above your heads. But it's the case. It is true. You're better able to understand problems that are presented to the team because with a big, cohesive, diverse team, you're able to get a broad set of inputs and a broad range of experiences brought to the team. So you get new ideas and better ideas, which leads to better productivity and reduced downtime due to those externalities. Look, at my previous job, going to the doctor or taking my husband to the doctor because he doesn't drive was a big deal. Fill out a form and do this thing and to be able to take 4 hours of sick leave to go and take my husband to the doctor. All right, my current job, because of empathy, we have completely flexible schedules. My boss wants me to work about 40 a week. A little more some weeks, a little less some others. It all comes out in the wash. And if I need to take Stephen to the doctor, or go to the doctor, or run an errand, or whatever, I sign off the IRC and say, I'll be back in an hour. See you. That reduces downtime due to those externalities. Better relationships with the leader. Managers, have you ever had people working for you who did not respect you but feared you? If you're one of those managers, please let me know after the talk so I can avoid you like the plague, because you are a dangerous human being. But yet, I hear stories over and over and over and over again about people who are scared of their boss for one reason or another. Do you know if the people who work for you are scared of you or not? If you don't know, maybe you ought to find out. And then find out why. And what does it take to find that out and find out why? Vulnerability, empathy, compassion. Rear Admiral Hopper said it, leadership is a two-way street. Respect up, respect down. Respect leads to loyalty. Respect for your superiors, care for your crew. I don't know how to say it any better than Dr. Hopper did. I mean, really. Why is empathy important in software development? Now, the more enlightened among you will probably already know what this is going to look like. I don't know about you, but I got into software because I like solving problems. And whether it's other people's problems or my own itch that I'm trying to scratch, that's why I write software, to solve problems. Now, how many of you are in the software business because you figured out just as you got out of high school that that's a good way to make a lot of dang money? No? Well, okay, yeah, I see some, Well, it is. And it partly is because it solves people's problems. You want to do something that's used by people and is meaningful. How many of you have written a great huge piece of software and put it out there and don't care if anybody ever forks it and uses it? Right, I didn't think so. To design something that people are going to use, it needs to fill a need for them. Clearly, they have to have an itch before you can scratch it, right? Or you have to have an itch before you can scratch it. But to make it meaningful and useful, you've got to understand the pain points. You've got to understand their life, their concern, their beliefs about the process that you're trying to modify. And as you get feedback on that, what's this start to look like? An agile circle? This starts to look agile. Empathy is an agile practice. It's one that's not listed in the manifesto directly, but it probably should have been. Empathy is an agile practice. And if you're not practicing it, maybe you're missing out on something really important about agile. Curtis Poe owns a big software consultancy in France. He's an American expat. He wrote a great new game called Tau Station, which is all in Perl, by the way. And he is fussy about who he hires. And he hires for empathy. Because he's seen developers who don't practice empathy, and then they have a hard time doing the job. Now, that's not to say that empathy is the solution to all problems. It is not. There are still hard technical challenges for us to deal with. That's what we do. But empathy is, as Professor Cohen says, a universal solvent. Every problem that you soak in empathy, that you immerse in empathy, becomes soluble. Political, personal, technical, name it. Soak it in the empathy of the situation, the understanding of what the other person is thinking, walking a mile in the other person's shoes. Helps you understand the problem, and all problems are more easily solved that way. Now, I hear people say, I don't have empathy. Or more commonly, they say it about one of their colleagues. Tough call here, but I'm going to make it. Some people are believed, because they are on the autism spectrum, not to have empathy or not to have effective empathy. Now, in a group as large as ApacheCon, we're bound to have a few people for whom that is the case, that they've been diagnosed or believe they should be diagnosed as being on that spectrum. Because there's a lot of us in tech. I get it. And I have a message for you, if that's you. Your empathy is as good as everybody else's. It may be a little harder to access. You may need a different set of tools to learn how to access it. But it's just as good as everybody else's. Don't let anybody tell you otherwise. Done. And if you needed a lesson in how to practice empathy, you just heard one. All right? Now, serial killers and psychopaths don't have normal empathy. Science, again, has shown this. There have been lots of studies on serial killers and other violent psychopaths. And their empathy is not normal. Now, remember the three kinds of empathy? Those people are extremely good at intellectual and emotional empathy. They know how to manipulate because that's how they get their victims. What they are missing is the physical empathy, and that's what lets them do the horrible, heinous things they do. So, a check. Does anybody in the room here a serial killer or a psychopath? Okay, checking. Then all of you have empathy. It's up to you to use it. Some of us or ideological reasons or our own bad experiences can cause you not to use it or to fail to express it as sympathy or compassion. That's what lets, you know, for instance, jihadists do their thing, you know, and behead people. Experientially and ideologically, they have turned off the human empathy. And it is a skill you can build. You can get better at this. How do you do that? How do I say this any better? How do I say this any more succinctly? Listen to people. I told you earlier, Brené Brown says that it's holding space for the other person's emotions, not holding space for your own. That's self-care, and that's something else. It's important, but that's not empathy. Y'all know who this guy is, right? Fred Rogers hosted the greatest children's show ever for many, many years. We is a better man than we ever deserved as a human race. In 1997, he received a Daytime Emmy Lifetime Achievement Award. All right, television program, they come up there, and most of these stars, like, thank their agent, or they thank the directors, or they thank their coworkers. No, 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 Fred Rogers gets up there, and he says, all of us have someone who have loved us into being. Would you take with me 10 seconds to think about those people who have brought you to the place you are? 10 seconds, I'll watch the time. And what followed was the most uncomfortable 10 seconds in television history. The camera turns around into the audience, and some people are sitting there shifting uncomfortably, and others are weeping openly. Let's do that, shall we, for our second exercise? All of us have someone in our careers who have built us up at a critical juncture, who have mentored us or encouraged us or done something to boost our career, and that's what's gotten us to the place we are, whether that's you're still a junior developer or you're a senior architect, it doesn't matter. All of us have somebody who's done that, and maybe they're gone out of your life. Maybe they're deceased. Maybe you've moved on to another job, or they have. In my case, one of them is sitting in the room today. But let's take 10 seconds and think about those people and thank them and be grateful for them. 10 seconds. I'll watch the time. Uncomfortable, wasn't it? Just a little. We're used to getting up and saying thank you. We're used to giving that person a handshake and saying thank you. We're not used to just sitting and being grateful. That is something we as a species are out of practice at, and it is a tragedy because it's so important to just sit and be grateful. Because when you thank that person, when you get up and say, I want to thank my agent for getting me this gig, there's this reciprocation that comes with that. But an attitude of gratitude, that sitting in silence and appreciating, has nothing to get back in return. You just give it. And it's so crucial. The more we care about the happiness of other people, the greater our own sense of well-being. It's not just the bad things that happen, also the good things. If a colleague comes in and says, hey, my spouse and I just signed the deal to buy a house. All right, everybody who's ever bought a house all of a sudden has this emotional rush of their own experience of buying a house, right? It's a trial. It's a lot of work. It's all the 50 times you have to sign your name and all these things, right? It can be good things too. And sharing those is just as important as sharing the pains. Michelle Barber wrote a book called Unselfie, Why Empathetic Kids Succeed. And in that book, she cooks it down to 9 habits that are inherently empathetic. They recognize their own feelings and those of others. They have a moral identity. They can describe, even at very young ages, 4, 5, 6-year-olds, their own sense of right and wrong, and clearly enumerate that. They understand the needs of others, sometimes intuitively, almost scarily. They have a moral imagination. If you give them a situation they've not been subjected to before, they can intuit right and wrong responses within their own moral framework. Young kids, 4, 5, 6-year-olds, they keep their cool under pressure. They practice kindness as a way of life. They think about us, not them. They think in terms of the group, whatever collective they are part of. They stick their necks out for other people. They are willing to take risks so that another person can benefit, and they want to make a difference. They are hungry to make a difference in the world around them. And by the time those people are teenagers, they're doing it. They're making those differences. All right, hiring managers, I believe very strongly, 30 years in the business, that it doesn't matter what language your shops use, you can teach it to somebody who knows how to program in any other language, relatively straightforwardly. Are you willing to spend that time? Yes, no, maybe. That varies. These are harder to teach, lots harder to teach, but that's what we ought to be hiring for. Because technical skill and technical merit, number one, is commonplace, and number two, can be taught. These cannot and are priceless. We've got to get more of these in our shops. Karen Armstrong, she did a TED Talk a few years ago, won the TED Prize, and took the $100,000 they gave her to start the Charter for Compassion, which says that its purpose is to create and define and propagate a informed empathy for all human beings. And the Charter believes, states that it, the belief is that compassion is a crucial factor for the long-term success of humanity, for a healthy, happy, peaceful world. Compassion is crucial. I stand up and I talk about this, and people get pissy. People get grumpy about this. Now, straight white guys, I don't want to pick on you, but all of the garbage I've had come back to me comes from straight white guys. You do the math. All right, people will fight me on this. People will argue with me. I've had threats of violence after giving this talk in my Twitter feed. It happens. Blows me away. The mildest response, before I'd even finished, one of the first times I keynoted this, somebody said, well, I guess our community has been infested by snowflakes. So there's some name calling that goes with this. John Cleese gave me this last year on Twitter. I saw this and went, I've got to use that. Snowflake, I've heard this word. I think sociopaths use it in an attempt to discredit the notion of empathy. You know what? They fail. If you're one of those name callers, and there's more than 100 of you in the room, so odds are one of you has done this, we have a message for you. And the message is from the Me Too movement, the message is from Black Lives Matter, the message is from every LGBT person you know, the message is from the environmental movement, the message is from every person of color you have ever met. Call us snowflakes? Fine. Winter is coming. Or if you like, the message of not like me-ism and hatred is becoming less and less relevant. More and more communities are standing up and saying, it's not okay. You don't get to do that anymore. And if you continue with this flawed, failed message, we have another message for you, and that is goodbye. We're showing you the door. Love it or hate it, there it is. What is real empathy? Sheryl Sandberg, in 2015, her husband up and died real suddenly. A month later, she comes back to work. She made a Facebook post. You can still find it. Fantastic, beautiful post. And this is the heart, meat, core of it. You know, it's easy when somebody's hurting to go up and say, there, it'll be okay. That's what we want to do that frequently. We want to comfort them by saying it'll be okay. Real empathy is acknowledging this is not okay. I get it, but I'm here anyway, and you're okay. It's holding your arms open for a hug. and say, it's all right. Right? And see, people say, oh, Ruthie, you can't solve all the problems. No, I can't. Look, I don't have to tell you. Let's circle back to what I said earlier about drawing lines. All right? And how we draw lines. I don't have to tell you about all the places in this country where a rich man lives within blocks of somebody who doesn't have clean water to drink in their home. I don't have to tell you about sexual harassment in the workplace. I don't have to tell you about places in this world where people will this day choose between food for themselves and their children. I don't have to tell you about the places in this country where people will have to choose between health care and food. I don't have to tell you about indignity and injustice and violence and warfare. We as a species are steeped in it. You know these things. And there is where the lines are drawn. Somewhere between emotional and intellectual empathy, we draw a line and say, this other who lives a different life from me is not worthy, and they don't get that dignity and respect from us personally and from us societally. If we got it societally, we'd all be equal. I wouldn't be making 77 cents for every dollar a guy makes. Right? And I'm one of the privileged ones because I'm white. And people say, oh, Ruthie, you can't help everybody. You can't solve all those problems. I can't solve all those problems. Right. You're right. But every one of us can help somebody. There's an old preacher's story my uncle used to tell about a young girl is down on a beach, and there had been a storm, and a bunch of starfish are washed up onto the beach. And she's down there on the beach, this young child, picking up the starfish and hurling them back into the sea before they die in the sun. And there's a bunch of people standing up on the causeway, and they're laughing at her. And one of them finally comes down and says, you can't save them all. What are you doing? You can't possibly begin to make a difference. And this hurt her. But she paused for a moment. She reached down. She picked up a starfish. And she chucked it out into the sea. And she said, I made a difference for that one. And the man thought about that a minute. Reached down and picked up a starfish. And presently everybody came down off the causeway and helped. We can't all solve everybody's problems. We can't any of us do that. But we can all make a difference. People say, Ruthie, you're too sensitive. You need some thick skin. No, colleagues. Thicker skin puts more distance between human hearts. Think about that a minute. Not just physically. Thicker skin makes more room for not like me. It makes more room for those people. It makes more room and more space for us versus them. And for bigotry and hatred and violence and warfare. And eventually, somebody pushes a button, and at the end of the day, nothing is left alive on earth except the cockroaches. I believe very passionately, colleagues, that our survival as a species depends powerfully on our ability to use empathy and compassion for each other's benefit. Without it, we have no hope. Maya Angelou said this, it's about courage. We all got it, except for, you know, those killers and psychopaths, and none of us are. Do we have the courage to use it? Do we have the courage? Humanity, we as individuals and we as a species, face a choice. And it's a difficult one. And the problem is, nobody agrees on the species-wide answer yet. But we need to learn to care more about the stranger sitting next to us tomorrow than we did today. And we need to do it quickly, or we will die miserable and alone. There is no third choice. I believe that very strongly. Now, it happens every time I give this talk that somebody has something stirred up. Maybe it's a story where somebody used empathy powerfully in your own life. That's fine. Maybe you're needing a dose of that acceptance, that empathy, that holding space. And you have realized, hopefully, that I'm one of those people that does that a lot. I'm not hard to find, and I'm going to be here all week, and I have no other agenda but this talk. So if that's you, and if you have a story to tell, and I have heard some amazing stories come out of this talk, come find me. I'm not hard to find. My final thought for you, and the question we need to consider as we finish our time together, is this. Do you have the courage to care about the stranger sitting next to you? That you have the ability, I have no doubt. It's just a matter of your own will and your own courage to start caring about other people. That's the only question I have for you. I want to thank you for your time today. I appreciate your time and your kind attention. Go in peace with my best wishes for you and the people you love. Thank you.
Thank you, Ruth. Any questions?
I don't have our time in front of me, so I don't even know how much time we have left.
5 minutes.
Oh, well, I timed that pretty good then.
Okay.
One problem I'm seeing developing is that loss of prior privilege can feel like persecution to the person who's losing privilege.
Mm-hmm.
And I end up in a sort of tension between, yes, I'm white, but I'm a female atheist computer nerd. 70 years old.
Yeah.
So I'm an outlier in a lot of ways. I see, you know, especially Christian white men who, so a lot of them do have empathy, understand the problems and so on. But there are some who I think genuinely feel they're being persecuted.
Yeah.
When all that's happening is they're losing prior privilege. And I want them to go ahead and lose that prior privilege. I want things to be more equal and fairer and nobody to have to do without clean water in their home. But at the same time, they need empathy.
They do. Those attacks frequently come out of a lack of empathy in their own lives. I see that happen over and over again. They are themselves hurting people. They are internally harmed in a lot of ways. Not by, you know, the privilege that they've been carrying, but lots of other things. They've been harmed in plenty of other ways because we all have. All of us, by the time we've reached an age old enough to be standing in a casino, have dealt with traumas in our lives, right? We've all dealt with something. And frequently, I find that those people who are losing or feel they're losing their privilege in that way, when they attack, when they come out and attack, and they frequently do, they're doing it out of their own pain. And the only thing we can do, you have a choice. You can block them, throw them away, go away with them, get rid of them. But there's a challenge there to embrace them and say, look, I know you're hurting. I know something's got you upset. And it's not about me being treated fairly. It's about something in you that you feel treated badly in some way, not because I treated you badly. You know, I call out straight white guys occasionally, but the reality is straight white guys suffer too. They have their own shenanigans to deal with just like everybody else. I mean, we've all dealt with traffic, right? We all have our own things that we have in our lives that frustrate us and harm us, and because we are really all alike under the skin. That stranger you greeted at the outset, you know the color of their skin, but you don't know anything about the struggle they're living with. And that's why it's important, I think crucial, to where possible, when it is safe to do so, and sometimes it's not, to embrace them and say, talk to me about your hurts. Talk to me about how this hurts you. And that can help close that gap a little. I don't think we're going to solve it today or tomorrow. We're here till Thursday, right? We're not going to solve it this week. But if we move the needle a little every time, we can make a difference. Thank you for your comment. I appreciate it. Any others? I don't see any other hands up. I can just barely see the audience. Daniela, do you see anybody else?
No.
All right. Thank you very much for your time today. I appreciate your presence and your mindfulness as I've been speaking. I appreciate you being here. Be well.